As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Real Blend, a podcast that spent far too much time this week discussing Jeff Daniels' toilet scene in Dumb and Dumber.
It's a masterpiece.
It
is a masterpiece.
Some of you might have even voted in our bathroom blend poll on Twitter. And for that, honestly, we sincerely, sincerely thank you for voting
in
that poll.
We
have to give some context there.
Well, later. Later. Okay. I mean, it's at the
In the biz, we call that a tease, Kevin.
My name is Sean O'Connell. I am the managing director here at Cinema Blend. This is episode number 34 of our weekly movie podcast, which means that by now you know that I'm joined every single week by the incomparable Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. Jake, hello, sir.
Hello, Kevin. If you don't get incomparable, how many syllables is that? Incomparable. If you don't get more than five syllables, that means he likes me more than you.
Let's see. And in the third chair... The king of the friendly skies. The king of the friendly skies. Kevin king McCarthy of Fox 5.
No.
In Washington, D.C.
That's six syllables, baby.
Well, I say that.
That's a multiple words.
I say
that's
that because
six syllables.
Kevin's not home. He's in another city. And Kevin faced a 17-hour delay at an airport.
That's why Kevin's dressed the way he is. He was actually he just gave up and became a flight attendant. Yeah. He figured it would be easier to get home to just start working for the airline. That's why he's dressed that way.
Yes. I've never heard of an 18-hour delay before. I was blown away by that. Actually, at one point,
I had that with Paris.
I think I was just impressed by it. I wasn't even mad anymore.
You ate the whole reel of cheese?
I'm not even mad. I'm impressed. What movie is that from again?
Anchorman.
That's right, because I'm not even mad. That's about the dog, right? When he gets home from work. Yeah. I was in Seattle with my wife, and we visited a bunch of movie locations, and then on the way back, the flight was massively delayed. So I literally landed yesterday in D.C. at 7 a.m., and then I went to work this morning, and now I'm in New York. And then I go back to New York Saturday. I don't know what I'm doing.
Well, yeah. Definitely part of the reason why we are not on the Facebook Live. We just decided to grab an hour and really fast record a podcast for you guys. So, just a recording this week, which you guys have downloaded on your iTunes or your Spotify, Google Play, and the like. On those portals, people tend to leave us reviews. We have no new reviews this week, but this is a reminder that we welcome you guys and appreciate reviews on iTunes. It's a great way to help promote and grow the show. So, follow us on Twitter at RealBlend. Leave a review, leave a rating, and if you want to head over there now, drop a review. We will read it live on the show next week. So no review means that it gives me time to slip in a very quick hashtag blend game that we won't normally get to on a regular show, But Jake suggested it earlier. I want to do hashtag back to school blend. Hey! I have kids who are going back
to
school.
Wait a second. Wait.
What? What? Yes. And oh, so wait. Just real quick, off the top of your head, give me a movie. We're going to play later. We're playing opening blend later.
Oh, but I want to just quick. I didn't know we were going to do this. I didn't actually think about what I was going
to
choose.
That's what I'm saying. Off the top of your head, tell me the movie that speaks to school, going back to school, being at school. I'll go first if you want to give you guys a chance to think about it.
Yeah.
There's two.
You can only pick one. That's the game.
I spent an entire day
trying
to convince you guys I want to do bathroom blend. and then Jake literally said, let's do back to school blend jokingly. Yeah. And then now we're doing that. And
well,
we can't do
it
bathroom
is,
blend?
There is. It's back to school. It's back to school time. It's seasonal.
I'm incomparable, for God's sake.
This is seasonal. I'm going to pick Rodney Dangerfield's Back to School. Which to me
I love that dive.
It's one of the funniest movies of all time. It has the greatest one-liners of any film I've ever seen. It's like Rodney took the best of his act and poured it into this film, where he actually, I think the greatest line in that movie, which might be one of my favorite one-liners in any comedy ever, is when he asks Sally Kellerman, his English teacher, to be his tutor, and he says, "You can help me straighten out my Longfellow." tremendous. But I love Back to School, so
see,
that's
Kevin,
my choice.
What that joke means is what he actually wants.
He doesn't understand poetry.
Yeah,
I don't get that joke.
He needs help with poetry. So, Jake, do you have one?
Does it have to be about going back to school or just school in general?
It's school in general.
The first one that comes up to my, like, in my mind, just because I honestly think it's just genuinely timeless about the politics of high school, is Breakfast Club.
Ah, good one. Very good. I thought you were going to say, what's the Robin Williams one that I was...
Oh, Dead Poets Society?
I was going to say Dead Poets Society, but that's fine.
Yeah.
No?
Yeah.
Breakfast Club rules. Kevin, got one?
I mean, again, no preparation. The first one that came to my mind was Mean Girls, because I like that movie a lot.
Mean Girls is great.
Billy Madison's a really good one. I just now, I Google searched school movies, and I'm like looking through the list here. Because
that's not fair.
The first one that hit my mind before I looked it up was Mean Girls. That's why I said that. But because Sean kind of sprung this on us, I do want to at least mention a couple of the ones that are on this list. Like Easy A is great.
That's good.
Breakfast Club, as you mentioned, Clueless. Heather's Bring It On. 10 Things I Hate About You is great.
That's a good one.
There's so many. I mean, I honestly would need more time to think about this, but. First one that came to my mind was definitely Mean Girls. I mean, really? American Pie is definitely great, too. Now, American Pie,
I don't
that's
think
a good
those movies have aged well. I tried watching one of those, I think the first one, like 2 or 3 years ago, and it was not nearly as funny as I remembered it being in high school.
Right.
American Pie has a great bathroom scene, though, if we can transition.
We've got...
but it is, it's a really great, I mean, it's a really...
I understand what Gabe
artfully
feels
done.
Like when we do these shows.
Yeah.
Hey, first of all, you guys threw a blend in that had no, there was no preparation for it. We have to give our audience some context about the bathroom blend. There has to be context.
Well, go ahead.
Give the background.
Explain it, right. And then we'll do news.
I genuinely do think that there is an art form to a great bathroom scene in a movie. And I think that there has been many of them throughout the years. Dumb and Dumber is probably the most famous one, in my opinion, when Jeff Daniels has to go to the restroom and after Jim Carrey puts something in his drink. And it's classic. And I here's the thing. And the reason I brought this up, half joking, half serious, was that I do think comedies are not ever taken seriously enough. Like Dumb and Dumber, I think, is a brilliant film. I think it's a brilliant script, brilliant performances, brilliant directed. But it will always be that funny movie to all of us, right? And we've never given comedy, in my opinion, the respect that dramas, this kind of goes back to our Oscar conversation from last week. So I jokingly said to the guys, why don't we do bathroom blend one day? Like talk about the best bathroom scenes. If you actually break down Jeff Daniels' scene in that movie, his performance is actually genius.
Just to be clear, have you broken it down?
Yes.
No, but what I do love is that what Kevin said that I agree with is he does a scene in the newsroom and everyone's like, oh, genius.
Right.
And then he does a scene in Dumb and Dumber, and everyone's like, oh, that's stupid. But
right.
I do agree with him. They exist on a certain level of similarity. I will agree with Kevin in that sense.
But be honest for a second.
What level like, is that?
It's acting.
Jake's mindset right now, in my mind, the way I'm perceiving Jake's perception of this talk, this conversation, is that he thinks that it's too immature to be considered.
No, it's not that
like
I think
serious...
that it's too immature. I just think that the performance. I just think it takes more to do other things than it does right. to show what it's like to poop.
All right,
I disagree with you. I disagree. If you actually watch Jeff Daniels' face, in
I
that
promise
Dumb
you,
and
I've seen
scene,
Dumb and Dumber more than I've seen The Newsroom. If that makes you feel any better,
since we're never going to be able to
and
do
I love
this
the
blend, at
this
some
is the
point,
closest that we will get.
I just want to highlight a couple of them: Jeff okay. Daniels and Dumb and Dumber, Van Wilder when Tara Reid gives her boyfriend that shake. There's a great one in Harold and Kumar. It's actually a battle scene in Harold and Kumar, the two girls. I mean, I'm being serious. It's very funny. If you haven't seen it, Harold and Kumar.
Oh, my God.
If you haven't seen Harold and Kumar, I think it's called Battle S.
He can't do School Blend off the top of his head, but he's got this short list memorized.
And you can't forget. You can't forget Finch in American Pie. What a moment. What a moment in cinema. I mean, I'm telling you.
Great moments in cinema. Well, so later on, we're going to do Opening Blend, which was a build.
I don't even want to anymore.
Last week's.
You guys, listen, I know you guys think I'm joking.
I promise you, I do not think you're joking.
Listen, I'm not saying Jeff Daniels deserves an Oscar for his scene in Dumb and Dumber. I'm just trying to expand the horizon of what we consider to be quality. And comedy is quality. That's all I'm trying to say.
I agree with you. I just don't think that, like, I don't know. I don't get up in arms over a great bathroom scene. Like, I don't walk out of, you know, like, I love Dumb and Dumber.
Okay.
I just don't, like, understand the necessity to, like, champion a great bathroom scene. I would rather have, like, sex scene blend. To me, it's much more impressive to overcome the awkwardness of sex in front of 50 people. Then do the bathroom scene. We're getting to move on from Gabe.
Last thing I'll say, not necessarily a bathroom scene, but also but a great scene that deals with that type of humor is the scene in Nutty Professor when Eddie Murphy's playing all the characters except for the kid around that table as they all like kind of pass gas or whatever. Again, a scene that would be shoved aside as immature, but if you think about it, Eddie Murphy playing all those characters and making it seem like it works, and then also adding that humor. That scene will never be recognized as the genius of what it is, really, in my opinion. I think it's always going to be pushed aside as a fart scene. But I'm telling you, one day, those scenes will get the recognition they deserve.
A filmmaker who will never have a brilliant fart scene in his films is Christopher Nolan. And in our first news segment, we learned that Michael Caine has the ending of Inception explained. Have you guys seen this story?
I didn't click on it because I thought that we would talk about it today. So
we are going to talk about it today. Michael Caine introduced a screening of Inception and was asked about the final shot, obviously, of the top spinning. And he gives a definitive answer of whether or not it's a dream state or the reality that Leo's character is in. So I want to read his quote. He says, when I got the script of Inception, I was a bit puzzled by it. So I said to him, meaning Nolan, I don't understand where the dream is. And I said, when is it the dream and when is it reality? And Nolan said, well, when you're in the scene, meaning when Michael Caine's in the scene, it's reality. So Michael Caine says, so get that. If I'm in it, it's reality. If I'm not in it, it's a dream. And if you remember the end of Inception, it's Leo going home to see his kids and Michael Caine.
Michael Caine's there.
Which means it's reality.
Yeah. Well, to me, it was always reality because whenever the top was spinning in a dream, it was always spinning perfectly. It was always like perfectly symmetrical on its tip, twirling. It wobbles a little bit before it cuts to black. Like it's imperfect in the way that it spins, which to me always said, I know Kevin's got a much longer thought process behind it, but to me it was simply that it's reality because it's imperfect in the way that it wobbles.
But this is definitive. I mean, if this is what he told Caine in the filming of this movie, that when you're in the scene, it's reality. That's it, Kevin. How can you disagree with that?
Nolan also seems like the type of director to tell 10 different actors 10 different things.
Exactly. It's the same thing as when they were shooting Avengers Infinity War or whatever, and they're giving the actors half the scripts. There's been famous stories of Nolan delivering his scripts, I don't know if they're true or not, with like a security person. Person reads it, and then they give it back to him right away, and then bring it. They can't even keep the scripts at home. I think that no one knows the truth to it except for Nolan. I think that Nolan has a definitive mindset, and I think he told people what they needed to hear in order to perform the scenes. And I don't think any actor in Pulp Fiction knows what really is in that briefcase. I think it's just an idea.
I don't think Tarantino knows what's in that briefcase.
I don't think, yeah. Probably I mean, not. Here's the thing. With Inception, which is one of the greatest endings ever, so correct me if I'm wrong, if it keeps spinning, it's a dream. If it falls, it's reality. Right, Jake?
Yeah, that's correct.
Right. So it starts to wobble. I mean, that shot is genius. I remember, oh, you know what? I did, if I could find the audio, I asked Wally Pfister what happened the moment it went to black. Like, did it fall immediately? Did it keep spinning for another, you know, a minute or two? I can't remember what he said. But I actually questioned him about that because I wanted to know, like, you know, when you got that shot, what happened after we went to black? How much longer did it actually spin? So I don't fully believe that Michael Caine, I'm not saying Michael Caine's lying. I'm sure Michael Caine actually did get that response from Nolan. I just don't believe that it's that cut and dry. Because, and I've told you guys a million times my theory. I think the whole thing's a dream from the middle of the film on, the moment when DiCaprio gets up and goes to the bathroom and Ken Watanabe walks in and the totem falls off the sink. Why else would you have that scene and not have him re-spin it if that's not the case? That's just my opinion. But I still, yeah, I don't buy it.
So you think something... I believe Michael Caine. I mean, I believe that what Michael Caine is saying is that that's what he believes. And I believe Nolan would have told him back in the day. Because I don't even know with Inception if Nolan was fully into his I'm Christopher Nolan and everything has to be twisty-turny. I think he was still just making movies at that point.
No, Memento was already down that path. Have you ever seen him, like, break down the Memento? I posted this on Twitter the other day.
I saw the chalkboard.
Unbelievable. He's, like, explaining Memento.
Yeah.
And I got lost in the first 10 seconds. Like, it's the way he was dividing it up. So, I don't know. Jake, what are your thoughts? Like, do you think Michael Caine is definitively saying that it is a dream?
I mean, honestly, it goes along with what I already thought. So, I'll take any evidence to prove that I'm right. So, I'm going to go along with it just because I agreed with it before I even heard that.
So, you think the ending is reality?
Yes, and honestly, it helps me sleep. It doesn't help me sleep at night, but it helps me sleep at night, metaphorically speaking, thinking about the fact that DiCaprio got home to his kids.
Yeah, like, that's the ending that I want.
Yeah, that's what I want it to be. In reality, these are fictional characters, and nothing happens after it goes to black because it's a fictional story.
It's a great top wobble.
Yeah, the fact that we're still talking about it almost a decade later is fantastic, but in my head, I tell myself that dude is at home with his kids right now.
And the beauty of it is...
And now I want to watch it.
You can sit there and think that. I think we all wish that it's almost like the perfect ending, because had we actually figured out what was going on,
says yeah, three I people we, who did not pick it for ending
didn't
blame.
Pick it. No, didn't even pick
well,
it.
But it's nowhere near the endings that I think we chose. But it's very good. But I do think that the ending, to me, had it been cookie cutter and we found out exactly what was going on, dream or reality, we'd be satisfied, but we wouldn't be chewing on it like we are. I think we've all come to a realization that we want it to be reality, and we just kind of like accept that it is. Because I actually agree; I think it's reality as well. But I don't. But I'm not saying I agree with Michael Caine and every scene he's in is being real. I don't know. It's interesting.
I want to jump to Star Trek IV and the fact that Chris Pine might not come back for this. Are you guys interested in another Star Trek? First, are you interested in another one of these Star Trek movies? And are you interested if they do one without Chris Pine as Captain Kirk?
Honestly, I wasn't even that jazzed whenever Star Trek Beyond came out. It's right. One of those, I love the idea of them bringing in Hemsworth, because I think, honestly, probably the opening scene of the first Star Trek is maybe the best scene in the entire series, where Kirk's father dies. I loved this whole, like, that got my interest back in the series, this idea of time travel and him going to meet his dad, and his dad being Hemsworth. That was fantastic.
I like that premise.
Once they lost Hemsworth, then I was like, well, now I'm not as interested anymore because it's not that plot, and now it's just back to being another Star Trek movie. And then once they lost Pine, then they lost me completely. I honestly never thought the Tarantino Star Trek was going to happen. I still don't think the Star Trek of the Tarantino. And we just interviewed someone who told me that he didn't think the Tarantino Star Trek was going to happen. John Cho told me that he did not think the Tarantino Star Trek was going to happen.
No kidding.
So, yeah. So I just honestly, no Pine and specifically no Hemsworth. Like I'm not that I'm out because I'll be there, but I don't care.
Did the Tarantino script involve those characters?
I believe it did.
Interesting. Yeah, I wasn't quite sure. I mean, that's such a pie in the sky.
Yeah.
Who knows if he really has that screenplay
right.
story.
I mean,
but
like
I didn't
that,
know
add,
if it...
Add that to the stack of things that Tarantino talked about doing. You know, there's a room somewhere with the Vega brothers and Kill Bill Volume 3 and now the R-rated Star Trek just like gathering dust.
Man, now, I
love those three movies. I love the new Star Trek. I'm not a huge
like
Star Trek guy.
A bit. Yeah.
And I think Beyond... I love Beyond... it's one of those series that I actually go to with the kids a lot. They are super into that rebooted timeline and they love that cast. And to me, I think Pine owns that role. He's so good as Kirk that I can't see why you... And I do also, I loved the idea of bringing Hemsworth back because this is a timeline that's been launched on the idea of time travel, you know, with the original Spock coming back with Nimoy. Re-establishing a new timeline through the fact that he created a ripple that you can play with, you know, time travel in a way. And so bringing Hemsworth back but then this is what's creating the problem. Hemsworth and Pine are huge stars now. Like, I mean, how you can't juggle them, you know, so if the two of them walk, you've lost your sequel and maybe not quite your franchise per se, but I'm with you that I'm kind of checked out if they're not doing it.
Two things. One, in regards to that, I love the first Star Trek, and I'm not a big Trek fan. And I think what JJ did with 2009 Star Trek, and kind of what similar to what Wrath of Khan was for me, where it transcended Star Trek. It was a movie that I loved just overall, not as a Trek fan, just as somebody who just loved going to the movies. Into Darkness, I think, was a major step down. Unfortunately, it was fine. Beyond was actually very good. Beyond was actually a step back up.
It's
fun. But I agree with Jake. I mean, the opening of Star Trek 2009 is the greatest scene out of any three of those films. A lot of that has to do with Michael Giacchino's score and just the way JJ directed it. But Hemsworth was great in that scene. It's an amazing moment. And I think if those two are out, I'm not interested. But I do have a question for you guys, and I won't try to steer this too far. It's kind of based on what we're talking about actors being out. Regarding to the James Gunn situation, I know that today Pratt came out with another quote about the idea. Remember that we talked about it a couple weeks ago where they all came out as a cast and released that statement. And then Pratt said some more things today about it. And Batista has been very vocal about his anger about James Gunn being fired. So my question is, legally speaking, every one of these actors is legally has to make the
movie,
right?
I would imagine so. Well, yeah, because Batista said that he was going to ask Disney to let him out of his contract. He didn't say, I'm going to quit. If they don't use the James Gunn script, I'm going to ask Disney to let me out of my contract. I would imagine, I remember interviewing Chris Evans for Cap 1, and he had mentioned that they signed him for 6 films. And I said, 3 Captains and 3 Avengers? And he said, that's right. Obviously, that's ended up changing because we're getting a few more Avengers. I'm sure they adjusted or added on some things. But I would imagine probably a similar thing. They sign him for a 6-picture deal accounting for, you know, some Avengers or some, you know, however many sequels they need to do. Guardians, maybe not.
I mean, and we all know that Gunn was very heavy in writing a lot of the dialogue, from what I understand, in the latest Avengers movie. You know, with the Russos continuing with the next Avengers movie and the Guardians obviously continuing in that, is that going to affect Avengers 4? Because Avengers 4, they haven't finished
Avengers,
it yet. They have to,
yeah, but I don't think it's going to impacted in
Avengers
that manner.
Avengers 4 is largely finished. They have pickups that they have to shoot before
in September. That's what the Russos told me. They had to shoot some stuff in September for it. Because I mean, like, they basically were shooting for so long. They were like, we have to release this movie.
Well,
here's
the thing that we realized today that I think will somewhat impact what's going to happen. Because I really do think that whole situation over there is very, very fluid. They don't know who they're going to hire yet to bring James Gunn back. We've been hearing stories that Kevin Feige or Marvel Studio Brass is kind of pushing behind the scenes with Disney to bring James Gunn back in some way. They have floated a few stories to say that, look, even if he doesn't direct Guardians 3, they wanted James Gunn to be on board to help them shape the cosmic side of where Marvel was going to go in Phase 4. James Gunn has a volume, a Bible of places that they can go with cosmic stories, which is why they teased Adam Warlock, and it's why he brought up the Nova Corps in the Guardians films. Like, he has big ideas of where they can go, and they're saying maybe we can bring James Gunn back in for an
If you're Gunn, do you come back in that manner? Like, if I'm Gunn, I say, screw you. You don't want me to direct 3. You don't get the package deal.
100%. And also this, with this cast, like, yes, so let's say they're contractually obligated to come in, but do you want that? Do you want that type of performance from somebody who's contractually obligated to be there?
No.
So Spider-Man Far From Home comes out in July of 2019. The next Marvel date after that is May of 2020. That's a huge gap of time that Marvel still has right now to play with. Their backs are not against the wall in the way that DC is, and I think they could really make a big production change of moving up Black Panther 2 or Doctor Strange 2 and just saying, we're going to shelve Guardians 3 and figure out what we're doing. Yeah, yeah. I bet you that that's not the next movie.
Sean, regarding your Kevin Feige comment just now about him possibly being behind the scenes and wanting or the rehiring of Gunn, allegedly, the firing of Gunn, do you think Feige had anything to do with that, or is that all Disney?
I think it's all Disney.
Total Disney.
So Feige probably was, we don't know this for sure, but he probably did not agree.
Is my opinion. I don't know anything about this, but I think that was the first time that Kevin Feige was reminded that he has bosses.
Yeah, right? That's actually an interesting.
Very good point.
That's a great point.
He's the ruler of Marvel Studios and is the creative point. You know, he's the head of the spear, but he answers to people. Everyone answers to people.
Someone's holding the spear.
Let me ask you guys this real quick. If Gunn gets hired back, that movie comes out, how much is it affected at the box office?
I honestly don't think that the average moviegoer cares as much as we do. I think it gets some press. But
I agree with that, Jake, except the Solo thing. I think Solo left a lot of money on the table because they switched gears to another director.
Oh, 100%. Well, that and the release date.
But here's the deal, is that I think whoever they bring in to replace Gunn, if they do bring someone to replace Gunn, is going to have to essentially try to replicate Gunn. I think with Solo, they brought in a new director to completely change the direction of the film. I think with Guardians, they're going to bring in a new director to try to keep that same feeling in there that Gunn created in the first place.
What about Sean Gunn directing? I saw that on Twitter the other day. I'm being serious.
Sean Gunn?
No, that's his brother. He plays Rocket.
Yeah. I don't think he's directed anything though.
Jake thought I was joking. No, Sean Gunn is.
Yeah, I thought you were really joking.
Sean Gunn is the actor who physically plays Rocket on set, and
he's Kraglin too. He's one of the human cast members. But I don't think he's ever directed anything, and I don't think he would take over a franchise that they screwed his brother over. He's been fiercely loyal to his brother.
Yeah, you're right. That's a good point.
In this whole blowback, so. I mean, I fear that you're going to get a hire of someone who's, I don't want to throw any names under the bus right now, but it's going to be someone generic. And right off the bat, you're instantly going to say, I'm not interested in that person's take on Guardians of the Galaxy.
Could you imagine the conversations that are happening behind the scenes? Like, what is Chris Pratt, Zoe Saldana, all these people, are they all at?
You know that, like, they have a text thread right now.
Oh, yeah. They have to be like, I would imagine the moment he got fired, like Batista specifically, because he's just so public about his opinion on it. But man, they must be like.
Also, props to James Gunn. I feel like James Gunn has handled this so well. Like, he hasn't come out. Yeah. He hasn't trashed Disney. He hasn't come back. He hasn't made some big, like, grandstand, stand on a soapbox sort of moment. He sort of just stepped away and is allowing this situation to play out. I think you could teach a master's class on how James Gunn is handling this situation right now.
It's an impossible situation to even understand how. I have a theory that he's going to get rehired. I think he is.
If he gets rehired, Disney will deal with an immediate blowback of people who are calling them somewhat cowardice for taking a stand against his jokes and then reversing course. But I think that's temporary, and I think ultimately they prevail by saying, we're sticking with the guy who got us this far. That's what I think should happen.
The only problem with rehiring him is the Roseanne story. That's the only problem. Because the Roseanne story is also ABC. It's also Disney.
And they say, why does he get another shot? Why does he get a second chance? Why?
Because both of them said horrible things.
Yeah.
And there's a that's going to be a big thing. I don't think Gunn gets rehired unless Roseanne gets rehired.
Her ever getting rehired.
Now I'm kind of backtracking because now I'm thinking there's no way they're going to rehire Roseanne, right? So that means Gunn's.
At least he hadn't started production. He submitted a script, but it's not like they're into it because, I mean, Justice League and Solo are two recent examples of, you know, people that changed horses midstream and they both collapsed.
Unless they hire Roseanne to direct Guardians 3 and then they're open to bringing James Gunn back in.
Disney, we have the ideas. Just call
us. Could you imagine?
You're on speed dial.
Honestly, with everything happening in the world right now, if that actually happened, I don't know how shocked I would even be.
No, I'd
I would just be
it.
Like,
I'd go with it.
Okay.
All right.
We have a better chance of doing Bathroom Blend than that happening.
We have three new movies that are opening in theaters this week. I want to do quick reactions to the three of them. Some of us have seen some of them. Some of us have seen some of the other ones. And then we're going to do an in-depth sort of dive to Black Hay Klansman, even though Kevin's seeing that right after we hang up from this one. Crazy Rich Asians is actually in theaters today, the day that we're recording it. I was surprised at how much I enjoyed this. I thought it was really fun. I'd give it 3.5 out of 5, and not so much for the story, which to me was kind of simple rom-com, but it's shot beautifully. Singapore looks amazing. John Chu lingers on really great architecture and the sumptuous food and the colors, and it's really vibrant. And that for that alone, I thought that it was, you know, warrants a big screen view. Am I way off from where you guys are?
No, I first, it made me want to go to Singapore. I agree with you in that sense. Yeah, I actually really enjoyed this film. It does not break the mold in terms of storytelling. I've sort of been comparing it to Monster in Law from a few years ago with Jane Fonda and Jennifer Lopez. But you know what? One of the and I can't take credit for this, but I read a quote of someone saying, you know what? Like, the Asian community should be able to have their own generic rom-com.
Sure.
And they, you know, and that people are looking forward to the day when it's not a big deal when a movie that is like featuring an Asian cast and directed by an Asian man is not a big deal for it to come out. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a ton of fun. I thought the performances were great. I thought all the characters were different and fleshed out. And I was never really bored with any one particular character was on screen. I was interested to sort of see what was happening. And even though it was a story that I felt I was fairly familiar with, I felt like it was fresh because it was told from the perspective and the viewpoint of a culture that I wasn't as familiar with. So in that sense, I would give it a big recommendation. I really hope this movie does well and that we get to the point where it's not, and I mean this in the most respectful way possible, I hope we get to the day where it's not a big deal when a movie like this comes out because it means that so many have come out.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about this film is exactly what Jake just said, is we've seen a story like this before a million times, but we've never, I personally have never seen it from the perspective of an Asian perspective. So you're diving into a story that you've seen. While you may know where it's going, you've never seen it from a perspective, in my opinion, that I've seen at least, like this, dealing with the cultural differences. And the thing I found fascinating about this movie was learning the difference between Asian American and Asian. And that's a very big concept of this movie, is that there is a massive difference. And I think that the film really dives into that. I mean, this idea that Rachel's character, Constance Wu, grows up, where is she from? New York, right? In the film.
Yeah.
I believe it's New York. But she's Asian. I believe she's Chinese, right? Her character's Chinese. So the character going to Singapore and then being a complete foreigner in the sense of like just not understanding this particular culture, it's an incredible way to tell a story. And a great way to have arcs for a lot of characters. You know, everybody kind of leaning in and kind of learning this difference between Asian and Asian American. On top of that, it's shot masterfully. I mean, there are some incredible shots in this film. Specifically, there's a moment in the movie for people out there when they see it. It's a 2 or 3 minute one shot, tracking shot, as John Chu brings Rachel and Nick into a party scenario. And she's meeting all the family and friends. And it's so much anxiety, and he keeps it all in one shot because it's meant to, you don't want to break that up. Like, you're kind of like, remember, you know, if you're walking to a party to meet someone's family for the first time, not on that scale, but you're kind of like tossed in a bunch of different directions. Like, this person's this, uncle, whatever, John, this, and you're kind of being like tossed around, you know what I mean? And then they go to these like documentary style shots of her meeting the family, these like head on like shots. So, very cool. One other thing I want to note about that movie, I liked it a lot, actually. My only issue with the movie is I think that it rushes when it needs to slow down and it drags when it needs to speed up. There were times where they didn't spend enough time, in my opinion, in some of the most important moments, and then they spent too little time. Yeah, it was just, to me, it was like almost like Whiplash, that line about rushing and dragging. It just kind of just...
Were you rushing or were you dragging?
There was a push-pull for some of the scenes. This movie contains top three favorite scenes of the year for me right now. The wedding sequence specifically, which is it's not a spoiler. It's just they're going to Singapore for a wedding. So that particular sequence,
okay, at the risk of us, like, sometimes we come off as like a genre superhero heavy podcast. The wedding scene is gorgeous.
Oh, it's
like,
fantastic.
Unbelievable.
It's beautiful. How they shot it. They do this. I'm going to give away something really quick. It's like a visual where they lay down this water for the bride to walk down, and everybody in the place turns to sort of light the scene in a way. And I don't want to give it away because I want it to be a bit of a surprise. But our audience gasped because it looked far more beautiful than they could even
moving hope. Forward. How many news stories are we going to hear about flooded weddings of people who attempt to like bring water into their wedding and it just goes horribly wrong? Like, I guarantee you, it took a lot to orchestrate that, and I'm sure there's a lot of movie magic behind it. And I feel like we're about to see a string of like another flooded wedding, this time out of Kentucky.
Yeah, but what's interesting about that scene, by the way, is John Chu, M. Chu, the director. He sets that scene to Coldplay's Yellow, but a Chinese remake.
Yeah. Oh, the soundtrack is incredible.
Yeah, that's another thing we got to bring up is the soundtrack basically features a bunch of Asian remakes of classic songs.
Material Girl gets one.
But specifically using the song Yellow there, I think is probably one of the most brilliant soundtrack decisions I've ever heard in my life. Because not only does that term... as John Chu said, when I interviewed him about it, he actually had to write a letter to Coldplay because originally they turned it down. They weren't going to allow them to use that song. And he wrote an emotional letter to Chris Martin and the whole band. And then hours later, he got approval to put the song in the film. You know, back when that song came out, think about what that song did. It completely changed the word yellow because the word yellow is used very negatively. I think we all know about it from like Westerns when they call someone yellow for like not... you know, not being involved in the shootout or whatever, calling them a chicken or something. But then the other aspect of yellow is the offensive way it's used for Asian people.
Sure, it's a really negative connotation.
Oh, but to have that song playing in that scene is so freaking powerful.
It's not the wedding scene. Yellow plays at the end of the movie.
No, and yellow plays in the wedding scene.
Is it?
100% in the wedding scene.
He uses it twice because he definitely uses it at the end too. I don't want to talk about the ending. But it definitely plays over the ending too. But either way, the use of the song is great.
And maybe I'm wrong. I thought it was in the wedding scene, but I could be wrong.
Let Jake, us know you on social.
I don't remember. Sorry.
Let us know on social.
Well, either way, great scene. And then one other thing I want to mention to give John M. Chu credit and the producers behind this movie credit, they were offered a massive Netflix deal, a huge deal at Netflix to bring this movie to Netflix. So that would have guaranteed them the money, right? They wouldn't have to worry about box office, and your expectations of what the movie should do are not really there anymore because you're dealing with streams now. Now, it would have done really well on Netflix, but John M. Chu said, you know what? No. This is the first Asian-American-led cast in Hollywood in 25 years as leads. We're not putting this on Netflix. Even though Netflix is great, we're putting this in the biggest theater possible, and we're going to have an opening weekend that's going to speak volumes to the idea that we need more diversity in films.
And it's tracking very well.
And yeah, they're saying $26 million over the 5 days, which is great because the movie only cost about $30 to make, which is, you know, it's still a lot of money, but not a ton where it won't be able to make it back. But you got to
I'm sure a lot of
credit.
That was just international shooting is expensive.
Right. But you're talking about this is the first Asian American led film in 25 years in Hollywood.
I'm assuming the last one was Joy Club. Yeah.
Joy Luck Club. And I saw a tweet today from Constance Wu. So a lot of reporters and people are getting this wrong. I myself got this wrong when I sat down with the cast with Awkwafina. I said this is the first Asian led cast in Hollywood in 25 years, and she said no, it's the first Asian American. That's a very, very important distinction.
Crouching Tiger.
Crouching Tiger, Memoirs of a Geisha. So just when people were saying, if you're watching this movie and you're tweeting about it, just make sure you know it's the first Asian American led cast in Hollywood in 25 years. Asian American is the key.
Okay, in a couple of hours, I have to go see Mile 22. Is it any good?
Nah.
I liked Mile 22. It's intense. It's 90 minutes. Everything with Ico is unbelievable. And that guy,
he's insane.
The Raid is one of the greatest action movies of all time.
Agreed. I agree with that.
And when you his fight scenes in this movie, in my opinion, make it worth seeing.
But
didn't
his fight scenes to me felt like they wrote the movie, cast him, realized, oh crap, we've got this guy, and then went back and retooled the scenes to allow him to fight. His fight scenes did not feel organic to me. It felt like they reconfigured the script in order to give him an opportunity to fight. There's one scene in particular involving a doctor, Sean, that you'll see a little bit later tonight. And watch that scene, and to me, it just stood out. Like, it didn't flow with the movie. It felt like they're like, oh, we got to give him a chance to fight. We got to give him a chance to show off what he can do.
Yeah, I can see that. I felt that the fight scenes were fine. I mean, like, listen, the raid is on such a different level of action that it's hard to compare the two. But I don't know. I think Peter Berg is making great movies. I think the ability to use practical effects and stunts that he does. His movies aren't doing a ton of money recently. Like, Lone Survivor was great and made a lot of money, but I thought Deepwater Horizon and Patriots Day were really, really great.
I agree with that. And this movie is as good as it is because of Pete Berg. Without Pete Berg, this movie would have been trash.
Interesting. Okay.
And I hated the ending. I think the ending is just really, really stupid.
Why are we not talking about the most important part of this movie, Jake?
What is the most
when the line say hi to your mother for me, that is a very
he does not say that in the
scene.
Movie.
100% he says it.
He
in the
does
movie.
Not.
Wahlberg doesn't say it. Someone else says it.
Wait, no. Two
oh, for
people
real?
Say it.
Someone says it.
Yeah.
No. Wahlberg does say it, or somebody says it to Wahlberg.
Someone says it to Wahlberg.
There's two instances of it. There's one with Ico when the guy says say hi to your mother for me.
Yes.
And there's another say hi to your mother for me that is involving Wahlberg's in the shot. I don't think he says it, right? But it's
the one that I'm remembering is where Ico says it to Wahlberg. I don't remember another instance of it.
Yes,
I'm fairly certain there's not another instance of it.
Two instances of it. There's one.
Right, I will pay attention.
Yeah.
I'll
pay say attention. Hi to your mother for me, which, by the way, is not a reference to SNL.
I don't buy that. I don't care what they told you.
It
I don't
has
care
to be.
What they told you. If
How
if,
could it not be?
If they were on set and did not and that was in the movie and they did not address the fact that it ties back to that stupid SNL thing, I guarantee they're lying to you, Kevin. Okay,
don't
it's not
call
it
stupid.
Stupid. It was funny.
That
it was funny.
Really,
but they're
sketch.
Lying
it's
to
funny.
You, Kevin.
It's
I do
funny.
Not believe.
Why would
that
he lie
was,
to me?
What? This is
what's the What's the reason not to make it a comparison?
Because I think that we would all recognize how stupid that is to put that in the movie.
For people who don't know aren't following what we're saying, there's a great SNL sketch that came out years ago where Andy Samberg played Mark Wahlberg talking to animals, and at the end
Mark
of that
Wahlberg
sketch,
talks
to
animals,
and he would end the sketch by saying, "Say hi to your mother for me."
Right. It's a very funny.
He'd say
sketch.
It to every animal.
Really?
Yeah.
And then Wahlberg.
How you doing,
came,
pig?
And then how you doing, donkey? Say hi to your mother for me.
Okay, that's like Tom Hanks being in another movie where there's a line. Life is like a box of chocolates, and him going, but it has nothing to do with Forrest Gump. And of course it does. You can't tell me that that people on set didn't address that. I do not believe what they told you, Kevin. I think they're full of crap.
All right, so here's what Wahlberg told me, and this is relevant to our conversation.
Because God knows he's the most trustworthy person in the world.
In the movie, say I think it's actually say hello to your mother for me in the movie, because in the SNL sketch is say hi to your mother for me, but I could be wrong. Wahlberg said the reason why it's in there, he says it was not meant to be an SNL callback. It was actually a reference to what Malkovich's character. Malkovich's character is called Mother. And then that's how they all communicate through the earpieces. So say hi
I
to
think,
your mother
I
for
think
me.
They saw an opportunity. They realized that the whole system was called Mother. And someone on set goes, would it be funny if you said say hi to your mother for me? And they did it. And now they're trying. Now I think they're trying to walk it back. And say it wasn't an SNL reference when it absolutely was. I don't believe you. Mark Wahlberg, if you're listening to this, you can tell me that to my face, and I will tell you back, I do not believe you.
So Jake and I are having a hard time remembering exactly. I think it happens twice, but it definitely happens at least once.
I think it happens once, because we like went nuts in the theater when it happened, and I remember going nuts at the end of the movie.
I will text you guys as soon as I get out of it.
And you tell me If you think that it was just organically written in the script, or if it was a bunch of like Entourage style dudes on set giggling to themselves and saying, "Wouldn't it be funny if we did this?"
I don't know if you guys remember, but I got to go to Bogota to this set.
Yeah, I do remember that.
And this is really funny. I didn't want to say anything. It's still not going to give away anything, but there's a moment where... So we interview the cast the day of this explosion shootout scene that we watched them film, like in the streets of Bogota. And one of the characters has a very distinct costume, an outfit. And after we interviewed the entire cast, and then after we watched them blow up the set... they were like, okay, now you can come down and walk the street and take pictures and witness the carnage that we created. And I go down and you see a body, a charred mannequin underneath one of the cars wearing the outfit of this person that we just interviewed. And we were all like, I guess that person doesn't make it very far.
Gotcha. We'll talk about who I think it is off when we're
yeah,
recording.
That sounds good.
Just a clarification, by the way, Sean is right. The Yellow song from Coldplay, their cover of it, plays in the final scene of the film. I can't remember the song in the wedding scene, but going back to what we were saying, the wedding scene is one of the greatest scenes of the year.
I know what it was. It was Enter Sandman. Didn't they play Enter Sandman?
Yes, you're right. No, yeah. I think it was Pantera's Cowboys from Hell. That's what song played there.
Gabe says I have to skip Alpha, but I want to quick just say that Alpha is worth seeing on the big screen because the visuals and the 3D in it are incredible. It's this, you know, boy and his wolf story, and it's kind of simple and... sweet. It's definitely sweet. And Cody Smith McPhee is the kid. I didn't even realize that. He's really good in it. But this movie is stunningly visually beautiful. I did not expect it. They handed me 3D glasses on the way in. I was like, why do I have 3D glasses for Alpha? But it was beautiful. The 3D is some of the best I've seen on screen, at least this year, and probably not in a while. So if you are even remotely curious about seeing Alpha, make sure you go see it on the big screen. Jake, let's quick dive into just Black K Klansman for a minute.
Yeah. Whoa, wait, why are you calling it Black K Klansman? Is that the right way to say it?
I've just been calling it Black Klansman.
Me too.
I have no clue how to. Well, it's the word black.
Yeah, but I thought that like KKK. The third K was like for K, like just like honestly, I thought the extra K was just sort of a fun little thing.
Spike Lee's.
I didn't think it was meant to be. I didn't think it was actually meant to be like pronounced. I think it's just Black Klansman.
Black Klansman. Okay.
And I said Black Klansman in front of. John David Washington when we had him on the show, and he didn't correct me, so I don't know.
I don't doubt that I'm saying it wrong. I'm actually 100% confident that I'm not saying it the right way.
It's Black Klansman.
Black Klansman. Is that right? Can I say it that way? Jake, my argument with this movie, and I don't want to say too much about it now because Kevin's going to go see it right after we record this. I think that it's an important movie, but I think that that's making it feel like more that people are thinking it's a great movie when it's really just a good movie.
I think that's fair. I think that there are some sequences in the film where Spike Lee is a little bit out of his element. There's some, I don't know if you would call it an action sequence, but in the final act there's somewhat kind of a chase slash action sequence that reminded me that Spike Lee doesn't really know how to do that. So by no means is it a perfect film. I kind of wish maybe he'd brought in someone that kind of knew how to do stuff like that. That felt a little clunky, but when it's good, I just thought it was just so unbelievably good. And I really was impressed with how funny it was. And it sounds, I mean, granted, there are truly horrific moments in this film and the final probably 45 seconds hits you over the head with a sledgehammer, of guilt. But there were just moments that I felt like he is owning the KKK with humor. He is providing a situation, a truthful situation in which we can laugh at them and make fun of them. And to me, that is one of the ultimate victory. When you can beat someone, not with turning up the dramatic music or by making me weep, but by just like pointing out how absolutely ridiculous they are. To me, that is the ultimate victory. So in that sense, I thought the film was a big victory for Spike Lee. I'm not sold on everything he does. I think his hits are as great as his misses are bad. By no means am I like this Spike Lee apologist, but I am all for. I think this is one of his absolute best, and I'm not sure it'll make my top 10 list at the end of the year. But I'm a big champion of this film.
Well, is there a floating dolly shot in the movie? That's all I care about.
Yes, okay.
Because I think those are. Sean, I'm sorry I cut you off. I haven't seen the film yet. I'm going to see it in literally 45 minutes. That shot to me has always been iconic, and I think
that's his thing. That's his bit.
He's made like at least 10 great films. I mean, the guy is an amazing filmmaker. He got Game. I can list them all. He got Game, Do the Right Thing, Malcolm X, 25th Hour. I haven't seen this one yet.
I hate 25th Hour.
Oh, I love, that's probably my second favorite of his.
Why?
I love 25th Hour. I love 25th Hour.
The mirror,
hour.
Scene is so great. No. But I mean, that Inside Man, another great one.
No, I didn't like Inside Man.
It's good. But it's good. I think a lot of Spike's movies are good. Yeah. Great.
A lot of them are fine.
I'd give him five. I'd
do the right thing.
I'd give him five great, which five great still, ones. Five great is...
Tremendous.
Yeah.
Tremendous.
That's, but absolutely. I wouldn't say 10.
Do you know my favorite scene in this movie, Jake, was the nightclub scene where the girl near the beginning,
yeah,
where she dances, where they're dancing and yeah, they're just letting loose and relaxing, because there's the split in this movie is do you have to be political all the time, right? Can't you just sometimes have a life where you're just enjoying being alive? And it's almost like characters throughout this movie are constantly reminded that you have to constantly be engaged in this battle, right? You can't just let your hair down. But then there's a moment where Spike lets them let their hair down. And I was like, this is a moment of reprieve that I think the movie earned and these characters desperately needed. But the reason why I say that I don't think that it's going to be remembered necessarily as one of the year's great movies is because I don't see it on my top 10. And I don't see making a push for an awards race, you know, for this. And not that those are the parameters,
I mean, August is a weird release date if they really thought it had some potential. I think it's going to be one of those movies that everyone agrees is a great movie. But then when it comes time to award season, everyone goes, it doesn't quite. Because the problem is, you know, and we'll, when we get back to the award season, we'll talk about this. But unfortunately, to really be an awards contender, you've got to have a small but passionate fan base of people that are going to put you number one when they when you rank on the Oscars ballot. And I know a lot of people that like this movie, but I don't know anyone that's going to rank it number one. And that's the problem, is that you need, even if it's a small group, you need at least a small group of people that are going to rank it at the top of the list. And I do think that there is a cameo in the film. Can I say who it is?
Wait, I don't want to know. I don't want to know. I haven't seen it yet.
I mean, it's not a big deal. It's not a big name. The fact that Sean doesn't know means it's not a big deal. It's Harry Belafonte. There's a small great scene. I don't. That's the thing. Maybe cameo is the wrong word, but Harry Belafonte makes an appearance. I thought that was a great scene. That's the one that weeks later I'm still thinking about.
I think we would both recommend it. We would absolutely say go see it. But it's not subtle.
No. Especially the final 60 seconds are not subtle by any stretch of the imagination.
It's made for one audience, right? Yeah. Like, I think a better movie, not that you could really say, let's hear the KKK side.
Yeah.
I'm just saying maybe a better movie might have found a little bit more balance beyond just...
don't know. I am not familiar with the film Birth of a Nation. I'm aware of what it is, and I'm aware of its perspective and its place in history. But apparently there are editing choices and artistic choices within Black Klansmen that purposefully copy Birth of a Nation as if to sort of like take it back from that obviously very like pro-KK film from the 1930s?
I think it was earlier than that. I think it was like 1914 something like that. Yeah.
So there are apparently artistic choices. I wish I were more familiar with that original film so that I could have like championed Spike for doing that, but unfortunately I'm just not familiar enough. But I thought that was a really cool artistic note.
Good. You're gonna love next week's game, which is hashtag Birth Nation Blend.
Yeah.
We're gonna review that great film. No, I'm kidding. We're going into this week's blend game, which is hashtag opening blend.
I'm very excited about it. What great two blends we've had over the past 2 weeks. I have loved these. I also love that we're doing favorite now.
I do too. It's a game changer. That is a game changer.
Literally, it is literally a game changer.
Gabe gets all the credit for that.
Yeah, that was a great call.
Everyone playing at home was amazing.
Can we have Producer Gabe on the show sometime?
Someday. He's getting himself there. He's earning his spot little by little.
Can I be the producer that day? And then I'll wrap all of you whenever I get bored with you.
30-minute episode. Yeah. Jake, I'm told that you get to go first. So lay it on us.
This one was a bit easier, and the one that I thought of initially whenever we mentioned it last week, and I've went through other ones in my head, and this is once again where, like, we used to have to do where I like had to remember the word best. Now I have to remember the word favorite. And once again, by no means am I saying that this is the best, but it is my favorite. I choose the opening of The Lion King. I think that opening 5 or 6 minutes set to Circle of Life is just, I mean, I recognized it as a kid. Is it being powerful? That song is one of the all-time great songs to be written for a film. The animation for that film is still unbelievably gorgeous. The power of when the title card hits at that final beat of the song, it makes me, like, I'm literally getting goosebumps right now, like, just talking about that. I just think that, like them bringing Simba up to the front of Pride Rock, I just think it is one of the all-time just unbelievable musical sequences, not just of an animated film or a Disney film, but of any film, period. And I think it's absolutely, like, I love that movie, but I think it peaks in the first 4 minutes. I think it is, love the opening of The Lion King.
Have you been able to see the sizzle reel for Favreau's live action?
I have not. But I have seen it on Broadway, though, which is, if you get the chance to see it on Broadway, it's as equally powerful.
So at CinemaCon, and actually at D23 last year, that's how long Favreau's had this. He put together a sizzle reel. I mean, people might not realize this, but Favreau's Jungle Book is essentially a feature-length test to can we do this, because they want to do The Lion King, right? And his sizzle reel for Lion King is the opening sequence.
Now, how did it look?
Live action. Oh, dude. As amazing as I'm going to tell you it looked, it's 100 times more amazing than that.
Wow. Now, it looked a new insane. Recording of the song?
No, they used the original version, but I think,
I think they are doing a new recording, which kind of bothers me, because I feel like that song's about as perfect as you can be.
Yeah, that they should keep that.
Yeah.
And you could rework the other ones if you want to, but keep that, because you're right. That is that is iconic. That is an excellent choice.
Thank you.
Kevin, I've been told that you are next.
Yeah. It's interesting. I think that the first one that came to mind is the one I said at the end of the show last week, which was Inglourious Basterds.
I was in very real contention. That was a great call on your part. That was in contention for me.
I mean, thanks, Jake. I genuinely think that.
So wait, that's your pick?
Yeah, no, it's my pick.
Oh, I missed that. That went over my head.
Yeah,
that's what I went with. Yeah, it's one of the greatest opening scenes in the history of movies. I was actually stuck in between three. I was in between this, the opening of Scream, and the opening of Dark Knight. The opening of Scream is
Don't get Sean started on Dark Knight.
One of the greatest openings of all. The opening of Scream was like so. Oh,
that's great. Have you ever seen the director's cut version of that scene?
No.
Oh, the director's cut. Really, the biggest difference with the director's cut is that there's more gore hanging from Drew Barrymore whenever her parents find her hanging from the tree.
So horrifying. Oh, that scene makes me... That I still can't get over the ending when Lillard and Skeet Ulrich are like stabbing each other. It's like, it's so horrifying. Anyways,
you know what's so great about Scream 2? I'm sorry, I'll get back to Bastards 2, but like... At the time, nobody was casting like big time A-listers and killing them off like right there.
Right,
it was Janet Leigh-esque.
Well, didn't you know? They wanted Drew Barrymore to be in the Neve Campbell part, and I think she's the one that championed to be killed off.
You're right. That's awesome.
Yeah, and it's iconic. Anyway, sorry, and the way she's making that popcorn, like over the stove with the tin foil, whatever. But Bastards, actually, the opposite of what Jake said, in my opinion, is that it's one of the greatest openings of all time. The film sustains that brilliance till the very final frame. Every bit of that movie is amazing. And it's not even my favorite Tarantino film. He would argue, and he's told me this in an interview, I think he's 100% wrong, that the Inglourious Basterds opening monologue is the best monologue he's ever written in his career. I still think that goes to True Romance with Walken and Hopper, but I also think that has a lot to do with, you know, he directed Bastards and Tony Scott directed True Romance. The opening of Bastards is a masterclass in dialogue and just the way he speaks to the milk farmer. And then you have this masterful shot that spins around and goes underneath the floorboards to the family that's underneath.
It's actually one of the scariest sequences of all time.
Horrifying. And then the shootout and the dust that's like in the room with the light coming in and just that music that plays as Shoshana's running off. And it's like, it was just, it's so horrifying. Every time I watch that scene, I somehow, and I think that I've said this before on the show, when a scene is so good or a movie is so good, I when I watch it again, I hope it changes somehow. Mm-hmm. So what I mean by that is I somehow hope that the family will get out of there before they come in and shoot everybody. And I find myself watching the scene going, okay, what can the milk farmer do here to fix this? Even though I already know that it's already printed to film and on Blu-ray and I'm watching it on my computer, yeah. I'm genuinely having thoughts about what the milk farmer can do to fix the situation. And then you have, oh my God, the switching to the other languages and just the way Christoph just walks through that scene. It's just as well directed as it's well written. Every bit of that scene is shot masterfully. Perfect.
I remember doing that junket, and that was really before any of us really knew who Christoph Waltz was.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting in that theater, seeing the movie, and just before we'd heard anything, it had to be one of the first screenings that they'd done, and just sort of like looking over to whoever was sitting next to me and going like, who is that guy? Like this, is this like how this whole movie, I don't know if I can handle this whole movie, if this whole movie is going to be like this. I remember thinking, because I think that movie came out, I think it was an August movie, if I am not mistaken. I remember... Yeah. In that first scene, thinking this is probably going to be my number one of the year, and it was.
I also don't fully understand how Quentin Tarantino wrote that scene and then sustained the brilliance throughout the whole movie. I mean, you got to think about even getting into the film, like the whole sequence when they take down the movie theater and they kill Hitler, and it's like, oh my God, the whole moment where like Brad Pitt's like having to like fake that he's Italian. Right in front of, I can't remember who he was talking to in the scene, but just that entire sequence when like she's walking through the theater and like it's just this long shots of like everything going on, and then the look on Eli Roth's face as he's shooting Hitler. It's like that whole movie is just perfect, every bit of it. It's not even the best Tarantino film in my opinion, but that says a lot to how great of a filmmaker he is. That's not even his best movie, and it's literally one of the greatest movies I've seen in 10 years, 15 years.
You guys like Bastards a lot more than I do.
Do you not? I did not know that you didn't.
I don't think it makes top five for me for Tarantino.
What?
Whoa. Give me your top five Tarantino movies. Because I'm very curious where this falls.
Well, I'm looking.
Where does that fall?
I'm looking right now.
All right, well, I'll tell you mine off the top of my head. I go Reservoir Dogs 1. Then I go Now, we're talking about just directing, not writing. Because True Romance is my favorite script he ever wrote. But
didn't you choose Pulp Fiction for Tarantino blood?
As his best movie. I did.
You're talking favorite?
Yeah. Yeah. So I would go Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, Kill Bill, Bastards. Django?
Django.
That's my five. What are your five?
I would go Pulp, Reservoir Dogs, Kill Bill 1.
No. Kill Bill's one movie. There's no one, no, two. It's one film.
Kill Bill
no 1. Volume 1. No.
Kill Bill 1, because Kill Bill 2 is really bad.
No, what? It's not. It's the same movie. What are you talking about?
Who are you?
Kill Bill 1 and 2 are the same movie.
Death Proof, split up by a Hateful studio. 8, and then Movie Bastards.
Death Proof?
All right, Sean.
Death Proof is worst.
Oh, Jackie Brown is higher up there, too. Jackie Brown.
Oh, my God.
Sean, Kill Bill is one movie.
Oh,
it was split up by the Weinstein studio because they wanted to make more money on it. It was too long. That's a
Kevin.
There was a trailer
I didn't see a full cut. I saw two movies.
The trailer for Kill Bill, the first trailer that came out, was one film. It was going to be one movie. And then they said, we're going to split this into two films. No, it's one movie. There's no volume.
How did you watch it? Well, I watched two movies.
Yes, theoretically, Sean. I went to a movie theater and watched Volume 1 and Volume 2.
Yes, but I watched two movies.
It's one film. I'm sorry. It's the whole bloody affair. I always watch it back to back.
Okay, I have a question. So... I watched, you said Death Proof. I watched Grindhouse all as one thing. So why do you split Death Proof up?
Well, he's talking about directing.
That was an experiment.
No, but if you're talking about how I watched it, I watched it as one theatrical experience.
That's interesting.
So then you can't put Death Proof on your list then, because it's one film.
Well, that's fine. Even if I take Death Proof off, he doesn't make my top five.
Give me your top five. All right,
well, can I do my opening? This could be another segment on another
show. Real quick,
show.
Sean, before you go to your... Real quick.
Gabe left.
Make Kill Bill one movie and then give me your top five. Make Kill Bill one movie and give me your top five.
Pulp.
You're pissing off Gabe, dude.
Reservoir Dogs. Hateful Eight. Kill Bill 2 really brings down Kill Bill 1.
No, it does not. What are you talking about? It's really the same... It's the same movie. He shot the same film in one
film. The second one is so bad.
No, it's not. It's the same movie. What are you talking about? And that dialogue at the end with the five-fingered punch is amazing.
What
is
Superman?
The Superman dialogue.
Anyway,
it's
so
like
your
masterful.
Opening. What is your favorite opening of all time, Sean?
Sean, what is going on?
Ooh!
Oh, thank God it was a Tarantino film. Oh,
it's Pulp
segues
Fiction.
So well.
Can you believe that? I mean,
wow.
I can't even
Gabe
believe
was
where
about
this conversation
to strangle
has
you
been
and he
going.
Just put his hands
no, Gabe
back down.
Knew. He knew the whole time. He's a mastermind.
Wow.
Gabe has orchestrated this whole
you
thing.
You sly bastard.
I had a very happy ending
in
mind.
What a great pick. What a great pick.
In La La Land. But then I couldn't really pick it because it's so modern. But it's so great. It's so wonderful. And it speaks to everything that film is. And I also was singling out Up, the first 7 minutes of Up.
Yeah, that couldn't be a favorite. I can't watch that.
But it's brilliant. It's just brilliant. But but that's not best. It's favorite. And Pulp Fiction, here's why I think Pulp Fiction is a better opening than Inglourious Basterds. Because it's so important later in the movie.
That's a really interesting point.
And it's, so when we talked about endings, and part of my discussion for trying to pick what the best ending was, is that it had to be the true ending, right? And so for opening, I wanted to, like the opening scene of a movie has to set the stage of some sort for what the rest of the movie is. Like it has to sort of lay the groundwork. Yep. The best ones do. And so for this, you're immediately thrown into a conversation. It makes it better than Reservoir Dogs, although it's close in that it's all dialogue driven. You're immediately thrown into a conversation with just like low level criminals. When the rest of this movie is going to be all about criminals and how they interact with each other. They're having this conversation about how can we keep risking our lives, ripping off banks? Why can't we just rip off restaurants? Nobody rips off restaurants, right? How many wallets do you think are in here? Oh, are the waitresses going to stand up for the? There's no way. It's an amazing conversation, and you're being thrown right into it. And before we can even process, like, who are these people? Standing up and
right
ripping
now.
The place off. And you talk about the ending of Lion King, how it jams. Like, those two standing up and screaming at everybody in the restaurant, you know, kicks right into Pulp Fiction, and it's like you're on this roller coaster.
I wonder if you could put Circle of Life over that sequence and if it would make it it's an interesting point because it's an opening that's made better by the ending, and there aren't many openings about which you could say that.
And think about how you felt.
Bastards does that
well. Think about how you
not
felt
directly when, I disagree with that
when you got to the scene. So when you get to the Travolta and Sam Jackson diner conversation,
yeah. And you realize...
Just think about the first time you watch it. Yeah. I don't even think I realized, we're in the same diner.
Like, it wasn't until you hear, is it him? Say,
Garçon, coffee.
Means boy.
And you're like, oh my God, he brought
it
back around.
Like a shared, like when we have like a shared universe, or if you're watching Castle Rock and someone says something about being, you know, related to a certain famous Stephen King character, and you go like, oh my God, it was like that feeling, but happening in the same movie, like not realizing that all this was within the same universe. Because by that point,
and
2.5 hours have passed, you've kind of forgotten about those people.
And then now when you go back into a rewatch, you can see Travolta walk past them. You see his
at the beginning?
Really?
At the beginning?
You guys don't know that?
No,
you can go back and rewatch it. And
I know that he says something different.
Yes, because Travolta gets up and goes to the bathroom, and he's over her shoulder. You see him walking.
I've seen that movie a million times, and I never
noticed Travolta's in the beginning.
I've got to watch this.
I know he's wearing that white shirt after getting cleaned off at Jimmy's.
Yes!
Wow.
Dude, I just watched it. Wow. He's over her shoulder walking to the bathroom.
Oh, my mind is freaking blown, dude. I knew that. You know that she says something different, right, in each scene?
It is different.
Yeah, and it was supposed to be because depending on who you were.
Oh, how you hear it. You hear it.
My question, and I've always, I'm bummed I've never thought to ask him this, and I've always wanted to know is why her mouth stops in the middle of the line. So right when she says, I will execute every last, whatever the line is, her mouth stops moving during that scene. And then it freezes, and then it goes right to the Dick Dale song. Why? Why were the last couple words cut off?
I don't know. Ask him. So that's why I picked Pulp Fiction. And listen, the Bastards opening is tremendous. It's an exercise in building tension. But because the opening of Pulp Fiction is so relevant to later in the movie, I just think I think it holds more value. So that's why.
And then I also love when Sam Jackson repeats the Ezekiel dialogue and has that arc of what that moment means to him and how different that... I mean, that it
What does he say? Like, I used to think that was just some cold stuff to say to a guy before I blew him away.
Yeah, and then he's like, I'm the shepherd, and you're the evil tyranny, or whatever the line is. It's so great. It's so great. Well done.
Alex Freeman, who is playing along at home, says Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
That was my second one. That, if we had done best, I would have picked Raiders.
Raiders is really good. Dark.
I think
Odinson.
Temple of Doom is the best opening of that.
Oh
trilogy.
God,
that is a really good one too.
I hate that opening.
It's a great opening.
I love the Temple of Doom opening. It's one of my favorite openings of all time.
I think it's very fun.
Yeah.
Dark Odinson, who is also our 200th follower, who we say thank you for, he says Inglourious Bastards. Kimberly Sue picked La La Land, and Kelly West said Scream. So a lot of the same ones we
did. Anyone pick Lion King
here? No one. Oh, yeah, I saw Lion King on a couple of choices. Yeah, definitely. But I don't think anyone picked Pulp Fiction, so I win.
I would like to point out that right now I'm holding a squeaky toy, and if you heard a squeakiness during the podcast, it is because my dog was chewing on a squeaky toy, and Gabe made me take it away from her.
Next week, we are going to play, mainly because I just really want to hear, although I think someone suggested this, but I really want to hear your guys' choices for your favorite performances by Robin Williams. So we're going to do hashtag.
I already have mine. Mine's it's so easy.
You can't make me do
it's
that.
It's so easy, Jake.
I'm going to make you pick your favorite Robin Williams movie. And,
favorite?
Favorite
is subjective, Kevin. I'd argue.
Don't give it away now, Kevin. Don't give it away now.
I'll just say mine is two words. So I'm gonna
don't
say.
Tell me. I don't want to know.
Forrest Gump.
Patch Adams. All right.
Thank you very much, Patch Adams. Thank you very much for tuning in. I'm sorry that we were not live on the Facebook this week. We will try to get back on schedule next week. We, of course, can be found on Spotify and Google Play and iTunes. Please leave us a review. We will read it at the top of next week. We can be found on Twitter at RealBlend, RealBlend. Jake, where can people find you on social?
Oh, you know, I'm around.
Kevin, where can they find you?
I am at Gabe Says Wrap It Up.
And I'm at Sean_O'Connell. We will put on Twitter the time of the next one. Hopefully we'll be on Facebook Live. And for now, thank you guys very much for tuning in. Play along with hashtag Robin Blend or
Gabe
Robin
is actually wrapping us up right now.
Let's do Robin Blend.
Robin Blend. Hashtag Robin Blend. And Gabe is saying no, no, yes, no, what? Hashtag Robin Blend. All right. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you next week.
Dunkirk!
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.